You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 11th of February 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, coming to you live from Studio One in London with me, Steve Bloomfield. Coming up in the next 60 minutes...
Conscientia mea iterum ad quiterum coram Deo explorata, ad conditionem certam perveni.
There will be a new pope. We're in Rio de Janeiro, Lagos, Warsaw, and of course Italy to see what the world makes of Benedict's surprise announcement. Barack Obama delivers the State of the Union tomorrow. A dramatic reduction in America's nuclear arsenal is likely to be on the table. One of the world's leading nuclear experts tells us how likely he is to succeed. Kenya's first televised presidential debate is on right now in Nairobi. We'll be in the Kenyan capital to hear whether it was as boring as the American ones normally are. And as if hearing the Pope talk Latin wasn't enough, here's Celine Dion singing in Mandarin. More Chinese singing later, trust me, it'll be worth the wait. That's all to come in the next hour here on Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. But before we get onto any of that, here's Bill Bingham with the latest news from around the world.
Monocle 24 News. Pope Benedict XVI is resigning on February the 28th after nearly 8 years because of his deteriorating health. He'll be the first head of the Roman Catholic Church to resign in almost 600 years. His departure is expected to leave the post vacant for around 3 weeks. The 85-year-old German's resignation letter said he'd come to the certainty that his strengths, due to an advanced age, were no longer suited to an adequate exercise of the ministry. These Catholics outside the Cathedral of St. Matthew in Washington, D.C., think he's doing the right thing.
I think he's in relatively good health. I think after you hit 80, and nobody ever talks about you being robust, but it's got to be one heck of a job.
Pope Benedict was a great pope, and he followed in some big shoes, and I think he did a beautiful job, and I can only hope that for the church as well, that it continues.
Journalist John Tavis has been covering Vatican affairs for 30 years and has seen Pope Benedict's huge workload firsthand.
A pope today has to conduct hundreds, if not thousands, of audiences, meetings, encounters every year. It takes a tremendous physical toll. And I think we've seen this pope strain under that kind of a calendar. Just the visits by bishops around the world, for example, take up probably months and months of his time each year. And I think he has genuinely reached the point where he says it's better off to hand it to someone else.
A gunman has shot and killed two women at a courthouse in Wilmington, Delaware, before dying himself. Police say the man, who's between 20 and 30 years old, fired the shots after entering the Newcastle County Courthouse and trying to get through security checks. The shooting comes as national debate rages over gun control in the United States since the shooting deaths of 20 children and 6 adults at a Connecticut elementary school in December. Delaware State Police Sergeant Paul Shabak told reporters the lone gunman walked into the courthouse lobby at 8 o'clock in the morning.
Two civilian females were killed in that shooting. Two Capitol Police officers were shot in the exchange of gunfire with that gunman. Their conditions now are non-life-threatening. The gunman is dead inside the lobby. We're still investigating whether that was as a result of the exchange of gunfire or whether that was a result of a self-inflicted gunshot wound.
18 people have died in an explosion at a coal mine in northern Russia. The blast at the Vorkutinskaya mine caused a tunnel to collapse, trapping workers underground. About 240 miners escaped to the surface. It's thought the explosion was caused by a build-up of methane. Syrian rebels are reported to have seized control of the country's largest hydroelectric dam. Activists and opposition groups say fighters have taken over access to the dam in the northern province of Raqqa. Reports say the dam on the Euphrates River is still operational. Meanwhile, a car bomb on the Syria-Turkey border has killed at least 7 people. Officials say the explosion happened near a customs post on the Turkish side of the border in the southern province of Hatay. The head of Guinea's armed forces has been killed in a plane crash in neighbouring Liberia, along with 10 other people. General Suleiman Koulefa Diallo was leading Guinea's delegation to mark Liberia's annual Armed Forces Day. Liberia's information ministry says no one has survived after the aircraft carrying 6 military officials and 5 crew came down in thick forest. The crash happened in Charlesville near Monrovia's international airport. 3 ministers have stepped down from Tunisia's coalition government, further damaging the prime minister's regime. The secular party of the president is unhappy that demands for changes at cabinet level have been ignored. The killing last week of an opposition leader has already caused political upheaval in Tunisia. The euro's jumped against the British pound and the Japanese yen. It comes as France prepares to voice concerns about the strength of the euro at a meeting of eurozone finance ministers in Brussels. French finance minister Pierre Moscovici is worried the rising single currency is making France's goods less competitive. The euro's risen by 6% against a basket of other currencies in the past 6 months. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Bill, thank you very much. It's 18.06 here in London, 13.06 in Washington, D.C. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 です.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
You're with Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. Since re-election, Barack Obama's focus has mainly been domestic. The economy, gun control and immigration have been at the top of his agenda. But tomorrow, when he gives the first State of the Union address of his second term, the US president will turn his attention to nuclear weapons and his desire to drastically reduce the world's arsenal. He will need to win over 2 key groups, Republicans in Congress and Russians in the Kremlin. Anne Penketh is an international security analyst and she joins me on the line now. Anne, welcome to Midori House. I mean, in a sense, Barack Obama has already done half this job in that he's already got the military, the US military, to agree to a 1/3 cut in the US's arsenal. But actually making that happen, how difficult will that be?
Well, I think that actually was the easy bit, in a sense, Steve, because the military, they've never liked nuclear weapons. You know, they're not very good for war fighting. They would actually rather spend their money, particularly at a time when people are strapped for cash, on men and on conventional weaponry. So, you know, having nuclear weapons is actually having something for a rainy day that you're never going to use. It is a deterrent. So having got the military out of the way, clearly he's got the Republicans in Congress that he will have to deal with. And that makes me think that he is not going to look for another treaty, because if you remember how difficult it was for the Russians and the Americans to get the START treaty agreed and then to get it approved by the Senate, it was a very, very tough battle for the Obama administration, much harder than they thought. So it wouldn't surprise me if Obama wants to cook up something with President Putin, which would not be a treaty, and therefore it would be some kind of deal that could be struck with the Russians in the same way that President Bush did with Putin in 1992, which didn't have to be approved by Congress. So that's what I'll be watching for tomorrow, to see if Obama says something like that.
When we look at the numbers, there's currently about 1,700 nuclear weapons that the US has. The current Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty START, which you just referred to, calls for a limit of about 1,500 by 2018. It's likely that Obama wants to bring it down to around 1,000. So we're talking about quite big numbers here. When you say, well, maybe he doesn't want a new treaty, he can just negotiate a deal with Vladimir Putin, how likely is Mr. Putin to be willing to make these sorts of cuts himself?
After that, the Chinese, the Brits and the French, they have much smaller numbers of deployed. It's about 300 in each case. So we're really talking about the American and the Russian arsenal. So they could easily come down to about 1,000. I think that among people who security experts in America, that there is actually a pretty broad consensus that you could come down to a, around 1,000 without causing some kind of instability, you know.
Yes, yeah. How many times do they really need to destroy each other? There's obviously a political element to this. This has been debated within the administration for a good couple of years. These options that President Obama is considering have been on his desk for several months. But obviously the presidential election somewhat got in the way. Do you think that politics will still play a part in this? Or is it fairly, you know, if he doesn't have to have a new treaty, can he get away with essentially doing what he wants?
I think that this is his advantage now in the second term, because it's second term presidents, you start talking about legacy issues. And I think that is really interesting. If he got the Nobel Peace Prize, essentially for talking about a world without nuclear weapons, even before he'd done anything. So if he's any sense, he'll now start earning that Nobel, you know, in his second term. So in a sense, if he can do this, he can win the plaudits that he won two years ago.
And when we look more broadly at nuclear issues, obviously the situation with North Korea considering a third test, Pakistan obviously now has nuclear weapons, as does India, and then of course there is the ongoing story of Iran. Is this, in a sense, is this a bit of a sideshow, you know, the US and Russia cutting their arsenals? Because, you know, frankly, no one really expects either of those countries to be using them anytime soon. Surely the issue is more about the one or two that so-called rogue nations might have.
Exactly. I think that it will come down to numbers. And even the most rabid Republican can look at this and say, you know, you just need a few nuclear weapons, really. I mean, in the context of the document that Obama and the administration have been considering over the last 3 months, there was serious discussion of coming down to 300. There are experts who believe that you can come that low, which could still destroy the planet several times over. Now, this figure was leaked, and people, you know, threw their hands up in the air. Oh, we can't possibly do that. So it looks as if Obama has backed off from that. But I would think that 1,000, you know, it's still plenty of nuclear weapons.
It is indeed. And just one final thing, with the Republicans in Congress, do they have a legitimate argument for why the US should keep the number they have? Or are they, do you sense, just playing politics?
No, their argument is we need these weapons for deterrence. But the trouble is that argument is now being so eroded by the fact that the nature of the threat has changed. We built up nuclear weapons during the Cold War in that situation. Now, what are you going to do against Al-Qaeda? Fire off a nuclear weapon to Mali? You know, it just doesn't make any sense. And so in a world of constrained budgets, you need to look elsewhere for your defence.
Anne Penketh, International Security Analyst, thank you very much for joining us. Up next, we'll be taking reaction from around the world to the resignation of Pope Benedict XVI.
From a breed of Italian sheep brought back from extinction to vintage recipes revitalising the dairy business in a remote part of Norway, Monocle Films brings you inspiring tales of mountain producers on a mission.
Mikhail's restaurants depend on locally sourced produce for its recipes, which have attracted a faithful following. It's proof, if ever proof were needed, that when restaurants work in collaboration with local food producers, it's possible to make a sustainable business out of organic farming and to create a distinct regional culinary identity.
Making it work in the mountains on monocle.com.
If you're on the go but still want to stay tuned in to Monocle 24, then download the Monocle mobile phone app. You'll have access to our live stream, past shows, Monocle's daily web column, and our 2525 city guides. And it's available for iPhone, Windows Phone 7 and Nokia N9 devices. So take Monocle 24 with you wherever you are, whether you're beachside or airborne. Head to monocle.com for more details.
It's at 19:15 in Vatican City, 18:15 here in London. You're listening to Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. The resignation of a pope is rather rare. The last time it happened was 1415. It's also a global event affecting Catholics all over the world. In a moment, we'll head to Brazil, Nigeria and Poland to gauge reaction. But first, Italy, where our correspondent Ivan Cavallo has been watching today's events closely. Ivan, welcome to Midori House. It took people somewhat by surprise when this was announced. How have Italians reacted to it?
I think people in general are speechless. I mean, I walked into a cafe to buy something, and people were just looking at the news flashes and were just incredible. I mean, it was quite amazing that the events and on the news, various broadcasts, I've seen people talking to journalists, talking to people in St. Peter's here in Milan. Everyone's just saying it sort of comes out of nowhere, because right now everyone is sort of in the midst of a national election coming up in 2 weeks, and now we're going to have a different kind of election coming up soon after that. So it's quite remarkable, quite stunning.
Well, exactly. I mean, you mentioned that election that's coming up in less than a fortnight. I mean, obviously, this is going to completely push the election off the front pages and off most of the inside pages, isn't it?
Indeed. What's possibly interesting here is that you see someone who has decided to step aside, where in the secular world of Italian politics, many politicians, almost all, are happy to hang on to the reins of power. And yet here we have an example of someone who, and it's actually been hinted now that the Vatican watchers have been out on the various news shows, they've been saying that he hinted that a pope should, if needed, step down if he doesn't feel he's at his full capacity. It was an book interview that he released in 2010. So it was not a surprise to everyone, this thing, but for the vast majority, it's just come out of left field.
And obviously, just finally and briefly, Ivan, we've got another sort of a papal decision to look forward to. All eyes will be on Rome within the next few weeks, won't they?
Now, indeed, this will bring major news organizations from around the world. They'll be camped out, so they're going to be competing, obviously, with the things with the election. But an event like this is, you know, quite historic, and it'll be interesting. There are already talk about even a local candidate from the Archbishop of Milan being someone there. But I think he's not a front runner. I think we're probably going to have to look overseas to where the church has a growing flock of followers.
Ivan, well, you mentioned overseas. That's exactly where we're heading now. Ivan, thank you very much indeed. We'll be in Nigeria and we'll also be in Poland. But first, let's hear from Sheena Roster in Rio de Janeiro.
The reactions and the feelings of people here in Brazil now that the Pope is resigning, it is a bit of shock and it's a bit of excitement as well, because this is the first Pope to resign since 1415. So, you know, it is making headline news here on Folha de São Paulo. It's the top running headline. There is one possibility who could potentially be the first Brazilian Pope, and that would be Claudio Humes. He's the only possibility that we do really have of having a Brazilian pope, but he is quite old. He's 78 years old, and that's the same age as Pope Benedict XVI, and the reason why Pope Benedict XVI is stepping down is because of his health. So if we did get a Brazilian pope, you know, there would be another question around how long would he really technically stay in power. That being said, the popularity of the church, as everybody knows, it's waning in Europe, but it's still on the rise in Latin America, Africa, and Asia. So even though it is still quite popular in Brazil, and Brazil is the biggest Catholic country in terms of numbers, its popularity is still waning compared to what it was in the 70s. There's a lot of neo-religions that are becoming quite popular here in Brazil, like the evangelicals. They're quite on the rise, and it's actually expected by the year 2020 that there will be more evangelicals in Brazil than Catholics themselves. So if the Pope that gets appointed is Brazilian, that could be what the church needs to keep its popularity up in Brazil and South America as a whole.
That was Sheena Roster in Rio. Now to Poland. Gulliver Cragg is in Warsaw. Gulliver, obviously, you know, last time out, this was big news in Poland because John Paul II had died. He was the first Polish pope. Is there any hope amongst Poland's Catholics that there might be a second Polish pope?
I don't think that among the serious candidates there are any. Polls among the serious candidates. Polls see the loss of Cardinal Ratzinger, Pope Benedict XVI, as the papacy getting a bit further away from Poland and from John Paul II, I think, because, of course, Benedict XVI was very close to John Paul II, a great admirer of him, and that's the reason why Poles admire Benedict XVI, even though he was German and Germany and Poland haven't historically been the best of friends. Today, Poles are worrying that the process of the beatification and the possible canonization of Jerzy Popiełuszko, the solidarity priest in Poland who who was one of the main priests active against communism, and also the process of canonization of John Paul II might be halted or slowed by the fact that Benedict XVI is no longer in the papacy. So I think they see it as a bit of the papacy moving further away from Poland and from John Paul II more than anything else.
Now, outside of Italy, Poland is probably Europe's largest or sort of most influential Catholic country. How much of a story has this been? I mean, are you expect it to be on the front pages and inside every Polish daily tomorrow morning?
Oh, absolutely, yes. There's nothing else on the news at all. I mean, this will be the biggest news of the week, certainly, yes.
In terms of what happens next, how closely will Poles be watching that?
I think that Poles will be watching it. They'll be among the countries which is watching it the most closely in the world. I don't know whether or not we can say Poland is the most Catholic country in Europe, or whether or not that title today belongs to Ireland. Of course, it depends on how you measure levels of Catholicism. I think almost 90% of Poles declare themselves Catholic still today when they're asked about it. But recent studies have shown that 40% of Poles only go to church regularly, which is quite a significant decline on the numbers that we saw a few years ago, certainly when John Paul II was Pope. But even if the numbers of Catholics and churchgoers are declining, I mean, the Catholic Church has a huge influence in Poland. It has a huge influence on Polish politics. So it's definitely an extremely important question, who will be the next pope.
Indeed. Gulliver Cragg in Warsaw, thank you very much indeed. We're going to finish in Nigeria. Tolu Ogunlesi is in Lagos. Tolu, welcome to Midori House. Now, obviously, Nigeria has a very strong Catholic population. It also has a potential contender to be the next pope, Cardinal Francis Arinze. How are people in Nigeria dealing with the reaction to the resignation of Pope Benedict XVI?
I think, you know, we must everything must be seen in light of this Nations Cup win. Yesterday, Nigeria won Nations Cup after 19 years. And so there's quite a lot of euphoria and excitement in town. So with the news of the resignation of the Pope, you know, is sort of like, an, you know, icing on the cake. Well, I mean, we're not rejoicing that the Pope has resigned, but there's suddenly this possibility that, oh, maybe this is going to be Nigeria's opportunity, you know, to have a Pope. But what I found out is that there's a lot of skepticism. I don't think people are raising their hopes in any way that there's going to be a Nigerian Pope. There's a lot of skepticism about that, and I mean, personally, on Twitter today, I had a lot of people dismissing my attempt to say that perhaps we might have Cardinal Arinze as the first Nigerian Pope. There was lots of people dismissing it and saying, "No, forget it." I guess that haven't been disappointed once. People are not keen to open themselves up for another disappointment.
Well,
that's
Tolu,
how I see it.
I mean, we mentioned Arinze. There's also, I mean, in terms of African candidates, Peter Turkson from just next door in Ghana. What would it mean for Catholicism in Africa if the next pope was to be from that continent?
It would be a huge deal, I think, especially when you think of the fact that many of the Orthodox religions, you know, the Anglican Church, the Catholic Church, Africa is where the growth populations are. You know, if you think of Nigeria, where more than half of the population is below about 20, for example, you know, which is what you find all over the continent. This is actually the future of the church, with birth rates not falling anytime soon. So with an increasing population, it's going to be a big deal if this part of the world that is a major growth point for Christianity gets a chance to lead the Catholic Church.
Tolu Ogunlesi, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. Tolu Ogunlesi in Lagos, finishing that roundup. And as he said there, yes, an interesting couple of days for Nigeria since they won the Africa Cup of Nations yesterday, which I'm fairly sure is, even in that most religious of countries, is a bit more important than whether they get the new pope or not. We're going to have a sort of popish themed music perhaps now. This is Pet Shop Boys, King of Rome. That was Pet Shop Boys with King of Rome. Any excuse on Monocle 24 to play a bit of Pet Shop Boys. In the next half hour here on Midori House, we're going to get the latest on Kenya's first ever televised presidential debate, which is happening right now. And also find out the new tricks for how Western artists are trying to make it in the Chinese music market. But first, here's Bill Bingham with the headlines.
Pope Benedict XVI is resigning on February the 28th after nearly 8 years because of his deteriorating health. He'll be the first head of the Roman Catholic Church to resign in almost 600 years. His departure is expected to leave the post vacant for around 3 weeks. The 85-year-old German's resignation letter said he'd come to the certainty that his strengths due to an advanced age were no longer suited to an adequate exercise of the ministry. A gunman has shot and killed two women at a courthouse in Wilmington, Delaware, before dying himself. Police say the man, who's between 20 and 30 years old, fired the shots after entering the Newcastle County Courthouse and trying to get through security checks. The shooting comes as national debate rages over gun control in the United States since the shooting to death of 20 children and 6 adults at a Connecticut elementary school in December. 18 people have died in an explosion at a coal mine in northern Russia. The blast at the Vorkutinskaya mine caused a tunnel to collapse, trapping workers underground. About 240 miners escaped to the surface. Syrian rebels are reported to have seized control of the country's largest hydroelectric dam. Activists and opposition groups say fighters have taken over access to the dam in the northern province of Raqqa. A car bomb on the Syria-Turkey border has killed at least 7 people. Officials say the explosion happened near a customs post on the Turkish side of the border in the southern province of Hatay. The head of Guinea's armed forces has been killed in a plane crash in neighbouring Liberia, along with 10 other people. General Suleiman Khalifa Diallo was leading Guinea's delegation to mark Liberia's annual Armed Forces Day. 3 ministers have stepped down from Tunisia's coalition government, further damaging the Prime Minister's regime. The secular party of the President is unhappy that demands for changes at cabinet level have been ignored. The euro's jumped against the British pound and the Japanese yen. It comes as France prepares to voice concerns about the strength of the euro at a meeting of eurozone finance ministers in Brussels. The euro's risen by 6% against a basket of other currencies in the past 6 months. And those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Bill, thank you very much indeed. It's 21:32 in Nairobi. It's 18:32 here in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. Within moments of the result of Kenya's last presidential election being announced, the country erupted in violence. Some 1,300 people were killed and hundreds of thousands were forced to flee their homes before a shaky peace deal was struck. Kenya goes to the polls again next month, and there are fears that it may end in violence once more. None of those held responsible for the killings have been put on trial, while ethnic divisions remain strong. But certain things have changed. A new constitution has been introduced, hopefully ending the winner-takes-all system, which makes elections a dangerous zero-sum game. And there have also been efforts to tone down the rhetoric and ensure that the candidates don't indulge in hate speech. One tactic was a live presidential debate, allowing up to 40 million Kenyans the opportunity to see what we all hoped was going to be a civilised debate. I was going to say it's just ended, but actually it began late, this being Nairobi. And our Nairobi correspondent, Tristan McConnell, was watching, perhaps is still watching. Tristan, it's still going on, is it?
It is, yeah. They've done the first half, which was about an hour and a half, and that was moderator leading debates and questions between seven candidates. We've now entered the second half, which is essentially a Q&A with the audience, and that's due to run for about another hour or so.
And you've been watching the first hour and a half. Often these debates, particularly when you've got seven people involved, can be a little dull. It can be a bit difficult for anyone to stand out. Was there anything surprising or interesting that happened in that hour and a half?
Yeah, I mean, certainly at first it began as a sort of series of miniature party political broadcasts and wasn't particularly interesting. But then the moderator, who's proved himself very muscular indeed, sort of jumped in with a series of questions on some of the topics that just don't really, you know, leading politicians in Kenya don't really have to answer this very often. Now, this is being broadcast live all over Kenya, so they can't really dodge the questions. And he went straight in with what you mentioned in your introduction there about ethnic division. He went straight in with a question on tribalism. He went from there to a question on the International Criminal Court, which is one of the candidates has been indicted for crimes against humanity for the violence that followed the last election. And he forced the guys to answer these questions. And it was very interesting to see them try and deal with these questions, you know, live on television, live on radio. And so it has been quite an eye-opening debate in some respects. And some of the lesser-known candidates, particularly a chap called Mohamed Dida, has, I think, gathered quite a few fans by being quite amusing in some of his responses and needling some of the better-known candidates, the likes of Prime Minister Raila Odinga and his main opponent, Uhuru Kenyatta, who is one of those indicted by the ICC.
As you say, Uhuru Kenyatta is due on trial in The Hague 1 month after this presidential election takes place. Certainly in terms of how foreign media have covered this election, that has been the main story, the fact that someone could be on trial for crimes against humanity at The Hague a month after being elected president. Has this really been a major issue throughout the campaign, though, or has he been able to try and avoid it up until now?
It has been a major issue. I mean, Kenyatta himself tries to keep it as a kind of background noise, if you like. But it's been at the forefront, really, the forefront of political debate, the forefront of discussion between potential voters. And I think Raila Odinga got in a good dig, pointing out, really on a practical level, you know, he said, well, what are you planning to do? You're going to run the country via Skype from The Hague, which I thought was quite a fair point, really, because it is, you know, the president has got to be here in the country. He's got to be managing day-to-day affairs. And if he's got to defend himself in a court in The Hague at the same time, that's nigh impossible. But, you know, Uhuru Kenyatta referred to these issues as personal problems, he said, which all Kenyans know about. He's not trying to hide anything. And his argument was that, you know, this is a job he's applying for, which the Kenyan people will decide. They all know the situation he's in, and it'll be up to them. So that was his response to the criticism he had to face today.
Do you think the fact that these issues of tribalism and the violence last time will help to ensure that similar issue, similar violence doesn't happen this time around? I mean, there's been a lot of slightly worrying comments and issues over the last few months in the lead up to the vote. But do you think, you know, having the seven people, the six men and one woman on stage, having to talk to each other, seeing that, you know, for everyone to be able to see that, you know, they're all, whatever their faults, they're all human beings. Do you think that will help to sort of tone down some of that quite nasty rhetoric?
You know, I'm not sure it will. I think the this debate is important. As you mentioned, it's never happened before in Kenya. And it forces them to sort of deal with each other face-to-face, whereas usually they're simply appearing before a large crowd of, in some cases, paid-for supporters, terribly jingoistic crowds who are all very partisan. And here they're having to deal with their opponents and also the Kenyan people at large. But when I say Kenyan people at large, I think it's important to know that this debate is being done in English. Although it's being put on television and also on the radio, it's not for everyone. You know, most people here are Swahili speakers or speak the local vernaculars. So the actual impact of this debate in terms of dampening tensions and so forth, I think will be limited. But the fact that it's happened at all, I think, is an important step for Kenya.
As we look ahead to the election, Raila Odinga and Uhuru Kenyatta, the two main candidates, it appears to be between them. Is there any chance that any other candidate can muscle in at all, or is this just a two-horse race?
It is a two-horse race to an extent. As you said, both of them are sort of hovering in the mid-40s, according to the opinion polls. Everyone else is far, far behind. But a lot of the pundits are expecting this to go to a second-round runoff, at which point the other candidates and whatever supporters they can have gathered in the first round will become important in terms of tipping whichever candidate over the 50% threshold to actually win this election. And that's all part of the new constitution. It's the first time that Kenyans have voted an election where the winner will be chosen according to, you know, the 50+1, getting a straight majority of the votes as opposed to simply first past the post.
Tristan McConnell in Nairobi, thank you very much. And you can unmute your TV and watch the rest of that debate now. You're listening to Midori House. We'll be right back after this with a look at the future of Australian defence.
We love to champion retailers who make a point of differentiating themselves from other offerings on the high street. Our latest Monocle briefing film travels to Buenos Aires, New York and Budapest to visit specialist shops where making is at the heart of their retail offering.
One of the big challenges with any denim brand, or any brand for that matter, is to really try and explain to the customer why it's special, why it's unique, and why it's worth investing, you know, a lot of money in a great product.
You can view handmade retailers and over 300 more films and slideshows on monocle.com.
On Monocle's Culture Show, we want to be like the fabled Hydra, one of the great monsters of Greek myth, but in a good way. Listen to one fascinating story and two more eagerly pop up to replace it. So it's only scary if you're frightened of the following sorts of things. Reports from all over the world on art, books, magazines, media, music, film, publishing, advertising and photography. Or if you're terrified of beautifully performed, intimate live music sessions from some of our favourite acts recorded in our performance space right here at Midori House. It's Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. It premieres on Mondays at 1900 London time, and frankly, it's the heroic Hercules that defeats the evil Hydra of radio boredom. Join us and enjoy the legend.
And you're back with Midori House 1841 here in London. The Australian military isn't what it used to be. Late last year, the government announced defence cuts that prompted some critics to question whether they've become too dependent on allies across the Atlantic. And things don't look to be changing soon. Just yesterday, the Australian newspaper reported that an upcoming defence white paper backs the cuts, arguing that an economic surplus is Australia's best defence against uncertain outlooks. So is the Australian military heading for a crisis? To get answers, Monocle's editor-in-chief Tyler Brulé and editor Andrew Tuck were joined by James Brown, defence fellow at the Lowy Institute, on today's edition of The Globalist, which came live from Sydney. First, they talked about how disappointed the Americans have been with Australia's defence cuts.
I think Americans looked at Australia in our mining boom and thought that we would be the goose that kept laying the golden eggs as far as defence and defence industry was concerned. They've had to make cuts. They don't really understand why Australia is making cuts, particularly given that our part of the world is starting to get more uncertain, more contested, and more contested with growing military forces in countries quite close to us. So they've expressed private concern and a little bit of public concern about where Australian defence spending is going.
Do you think there's a kind of a united view about what should be happening in the Pacific? You know, that America is obviously very concerned with what's going on between Japan and China, between China and Vietnam. And I wonder if they feel that there's a kind of those events trickle down through the Pacific, and then the people sitting in Australia should be just as concerned. But actually, Australia seems to be not wanting to get too muddled up in that.
Look, Australians have a funny history when it comes to defence. We seem to alternate between being very complacent and then all of a sudden becoming very anxious that we're in a far off part of the world and we're reliant on a great power like the US, and we're a little bit worried that they might leave us alone and not look out for us. Certainly there's some inconsistencies in what we're doing with defence at the moment. We're talking a big game and big capability, but we're not funding that capability. So the defence debate in Australia is a bit confusing, but the biggest danger in the Pacific at the moment is the potential for miscalculation between countries like Vietnam and China, or China and Japan, and for that miscalculation to result in some sort of escalation.
Mm. It's amazing when you look back, what, 24 months, 36 months ago, and maybe that was sort of a moment where this country was feeling like they quite literally might be left out in the cold. So we heard about, you know, the acquisition of two, not quite aircraft carriers, but to the untrained eye, they look like aircraft carriers.
They're enormous, yeah.
And of course, you know, a big spend on a potential new submarine program and many other things. Do some of these look like they might come under the hammer? Is this also a little bit this government sort of looking at what London said? Okay, well, we'll build two aircraft carriers, but we'll mothball one of them. I mean, what will this look like, do you think?
We're definitely going to end up keeping those helicopter carriers. They are assault ships. The government is trying to focus much more on the role they'll have in providing humanitarian assistance and disaster relief. Where we might see some change is in the ordering of joint strike fighters. Been a very problematic program. I wouldn't be surprised if the government cancels part of that order and instead chooses to buy more Super Hornets from Boeing, which Australia has already done.
Mm, I mean, and going back to the point about, you know, what happens with China, and Andrew was sort of referencing it a bit earlier as well. You know, here's a country which also has a very, you know, curious relationship with China as well, that of course, from a strategic point of view, at some point, could be a significant foe. But there's a lot of red lanterns out at the airport today, and very busy hotel lobbies as the Chinese New Year. So that you know, and talking about, you know, tens and tens of thousands of Chinese who are up in Queensland, etc. at this time of year. Does that also play into this? Maybe also this slight sort of rethink that maybe things aren't going to be quite so bad.
Look, Australians and Americans have a very emotional relationship, but Americans are still surprised by how close we are here to Chinese with our people-to-people links. I mean, I talk to former US military colleagues and they're surprised that I have family-in-law up in Beijing. And I think increasingly Australia is going to draw closer to China. Chinese airlines are becoming much more common here. And the dilemma of how we manage the two countries is something the government's becoming very concerned about.
Just tell us a little bit about this white paper then. What was its kind of vision for the future of Australia's military?
Look, the defence white paper that's coming up has already been leaked, and it's got more excuses, I think, than it has answers. The vision is that the strongest defence Australia has against uncertainty is an economic surplus. But other than that, there's not a lot new in it besides a focus on increased diplomacy in our region, both from the Defence Force and also from our Foreign Affairs Service.
Mm. Is that sort of a bit of a nice fudge as well to say that, okay, you know, we want to use more soft power, we want to get our diplomats out there in the region more. But at, you know, at the same time, many would say that, you know, good diplomats don't grow on trees,
right,
just like good generals don't. I mean, what do you make of that? And what is the Lowy Institute thinking of that?
Well, look, I mean, the Lowy Institute's written a lot on how poor the state of our diplomatic service is. The number of Australian-based overseas diplomats has declined in the last 20 years by 34%. which is pretty extraordinary given how many more Australians are travelling and how global our interests are. So finding good diplomats is going to be very tough, and we haven't seen any sign yet that the talk of increased diplomacy is going to be matched by hiring more diplomats. In fact, there's a freeze on hiring diplomats at the moment. The numbers in the last graduate intake were cut. So there's a bit of a difference between the rhetoric and the reality.
I mean, which is something, Andrew, which we talk about, you know, all the time. When you look at just the money and the effort and the resources that go into schools in Brazil, look at a country like Turkey. I mean, even the likes of Colombia being on the up at the moment as well.
Yeah, it's amazing. I went out to Brazil and, you know, went to the Itamaraty Palace, and there they have this amazing school for training diplomats. And then you look at the list of where they've opened missions just over the last few years, you know, everywhere from Pyongyang onwards. And they really believe in putting people on the ground. And I think that Australia is missing out because, you know, Australia is a bit like Brazilians. They're very welcome around the world. People like Australians. They have something, you know, that opens doors even before they arrive. So it's strange that they don't use more of their kind of diplomatic effort, really.
Look, we like to talk about ourselves as a middle power, as a strong middle power. The bureaucrats have been asking for the government to open new consulates in Shenyang, in Ulaanbaatar, and in Western Africa for years. And I think we've got a lot of skills. We've got great diplomats. We've got a really strong record on issues like nuclear disarmament as being an alternative middle way between the great powers and above the small powers. We're in danger of becoming a little irrelevant if we don't keep paying attention to exactly how resourced our presence in the world is.
That was James Brown, a military fellow at the Lowe Institute, speaking to our editor-in-chief, Tyler Brulé, and editor Andrew Tuck on this morning's Live from Sydney Globalist, which is well worth a listen. Go to monocle.com and look on the time shifter. Of course, you can download on iTunes. Right now, though, 18:49 here in London, you're listening to Midori House. And you're back with Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. Now, as we all know, China's cultural importance is on the rise. Increasingly, though, Western artists now see China as an attractive market to sell their music to. It seems that the old phrase, big in Japan, may be about to get a challenge from big in China. Just recently, Celine Dion performed in Mandarin on Chinese state TV to celebrate Chinese New Year. This is what it sounded like. Yes, there we are. It's not just internationally renowned artists like Ms. Dion who are flirting with the enormous Chinese market. Even in Finland, it says here small Finland, you know that's been written by our Finnish producer. Even in Finland, there is a singer who has now started recording her songs in Mandarin. She joins us on the line now. Sara Aalto, thank you very much for joining us from Helsinki. Or should we call you Zhu Lan, as I believe you're known in China?
Hi there. Well, yeah, Xue Lan is my Chinese name that I'm going to use there. It's really exciting to have a new name.
Now, you've already released an album in English. Why make the decision to release one in Chinese, in Mandarin?
Well, actually, I've always been interested in singing in Japanese because I love Japanese culture and Japanese language and Japanese music. And when I started talking to my manager about getting to Japanese business, he told me maybe we should go to China because the music market is so growing in China and they are really excited about new Western and European singers to come to China. So I thought, well, why not? China and Japan, they are so near. So maybe I could do it in both countries. That's why China, yeah.
So from going from that to then actually writing your own song in Mandarin isn't easy. How did you go about writing these?
Well, I always compose my songs in English, but then I have some help from Chinese friends who translate the songs, of course, because I'm not that fluent yet that I could translate the songs, but I'm learning.
Now, you've already had one gig in China, in Shanghai in November, but you're hoping to go back again later this year.
Yes, actually, I was performing there in November, and the Chinese people there, they liked me that much that they asked me to come again. So I'm going in May to perform together with an opera singer, Jose Carreras. So it's really exciting because he's like the most famous opera singer in the world. And we are performing together in Shanghai in May, so I'm very excited to go back.
And the first time you were there, I mean, what sort of reaction did you get when, a woman from Finland turns up on the stage and belts out a tune in Mandarin?
Well, it was really fun because they were, shouting and clapping their hands all the time. And I also sang a very famous Chinese pop song, and they were singing with me and dancing. And I talked something in Chinese, and after every sentence they started laughing and shouting, like, yeah, they really liked it. So it was really something special for them and special for me too.
And do you think that, do you see China as obviously it's great fun for you to do, but do you see this now as the growing market for you as a singer to develop your music towards?
Definitely. They are really wanting people to come there and sing, and they are so open for new things right now. They are really opening their market, and also I think my singing style fits very well to the Chinese market. So that's and to the Asian market in general, because my voice is quite high and my singing style is so girly somehow. So Asian people, they really like my style. So I think that's the market for me, definitely.
And when you compose songs in Chinese, are you trying to compose the same sort of songs that you would have done before in English or Finnish, or do you try to adapt them for a Chinese market?
Well, actually, because I've always loved Japanese music, so I think that when I compose, the Asian flavor naturally comes in, so I don't really need to even think about it anymore. I think there is already the Asian thing in my music, but of course in the future I have to think about it more carefully. Right now I'm only composing in English and do my English songs, because of course I'm also interested about European market, and so that's why I'm concentrating also in English and doing English music. But if the Asian market really opens up for me, then I will compose songs only for the Chinese and Japanese market also, because of course the music is a little bit, the pop songs are a little bit different, but right now I think I'm fine with the stuff that I'm already doing because of the Asian flavor.
Excellent. Well, let's hear one of your singles. We're going to play Ai De Zhu Fu, but I'm sure you can pronounce it better. So I'm going to Zhu Lan, Sara Alto, I'm going to thank you and ask you to introduce your song.
All right. Well, this song is called Ai De Zhu Fu, and it's a song that actually I also did in English. In English, it's called Blessed With Love, and it was the song that I sang in Finnish pre-selection of the Eurovision Song Contest in 2011, and I came second in that competition, so I didn't get to, to the real Eurovision Song Contest, but the song became quite a hit in Finland, and then I thought it's a perfect song for Chinese market also, because the song and the style is really Chinese, I think. So this is Ai De Zhu Fu.
想让我去赴，想让我去拜为奴。That was Zhu Lan or Sara Alto with Ai De Zhu Fu, best than Celine Dion any day of the week. It's got that Eurovision feel to it, even in Mandarin, hasn't it? That's all we have time for today. Thank you to our producer Marcus Hippie, our researcher Fernanda Augusta Pacheco, and our studio manager Toby Hammond. After the news, it's Culture with Robert Bound. Today, Rob will be meeting Mark Wallinger, the British artist who's designed 270 original works under the title Labyrinth to celebrate 150 years of the London Underground.
Every night I used to go to sleep with the sound of So it's like a very soothing kind of presence in my childhood, really. I cherish the Tube, yes.
And in 3 hours' time, 2200 hours here in London, Andrew Muller and Louise Beale will be here for the Monocle Daily. Hugo is here with Midori House tomorrow. But for now, I'm Steve Bloomfield. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.